Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to this edition of the Charlie Kirk Show. For a couple weeks now, we have been asking you to submit your questions to us for an Ask Me Anything, an AMA, as they say. And so here we are. We are going to be taking questions that you have left us in the comments section a variety of different other ways on all sorts of different topics. We're going to be covering a wide range of issues, and I have Mr. Producer here who will toss them out. So, Mr. Producer, thank you for being here. Before we do that, I just want to say, for those of you that leave the comments and that leave the questions, we do get to them. So right now, if you're listening to this and you have a burning question, go down, leave it, and give us that 5 stars, and press subscribe. You press subscribe, it helps us more than you could possibly imagine. Mr. Producer, what is our first question here?
Charlie, awesome content on all episodes. Absolutely love it. Could you talk in an episode on your thoughts about the $15 an hour minimum wage?
Okay, so we kind of touched on this before in a different episode, the $15 minimum wage. So this is one of the left's favorite tactics that they like to focus on, which is they say that we want to be pro-worker, we want to be pro-middle class, and because of that, we want to raise the minimum wage. And so I'm going to kind of build out an example that we used on a previous podcast before, and I encourage you to go back to that podcast. It was either the Joe 303 podcast, or it was the First Democrat Debate podcast, where we debunked the biblical basis for raising the minimum wage when Mayor Pete Buttigieg tried to actually break it apart. And so, look, let's first talk about what the minimum wage is. I'm sure a lot of you know what it is, but there's actually some more kind of technical differences behind the minimum wage. So minimum wage is a federal law that prohibits employers from paying below a certain level for people that work for them. Now, there are exceptions to that. So, for example, waiters and waitresses have about a $2.70 minimum wage per hour, but that's because they're tips. They're tipped. So essentially, there's a much lower baseline for that. So every state has a different minimum wage. Some city ordinances have passed a $15 minimum wage, such as Seattle and New York City, and some states have very low minimum wages. Now, realize that not all minimum wages are made the same. This is a really important point because certain states have much lower costs of living. So, for example, the cost of living in Arkansas and Mississippi is much lower. So it might feel as if their minimum wage is disproportionate or inadequate, but things actually just cost less in those states. And Tennessee is a great example of that. And so, for example, $8 will get you a lot more in the state of Mississippi than $8 in Seattle. Prices are a lot lower. And so arbitrarily saying you're going to raise the minimum wage will do a couple different things. Number one, it will raise prices. This is a really, really important thing to talk about. So when you raise the minimum wage, it is a mandate. You are telling employers, you're telling entrepreneurs, you must pay your employees more. So more times than not, an employer will react in one of two ways. They will trim off their least effective employees or their entry-level employees, quite honestly, employees that need the jobs the most, or they'll keep their current workforce, which is highly unlikely, and the data shows this doesn't happen, and they'll just pass off the wage hike as a cost increase on the cost of goods. Well, typically, minimum wage kind of hikes do not affect Goldman Sachs. Can we just put this out here? A minimum wage hike does not affect people that have high wage earners. This is usually and typically entry-level employees that are at restaurants and that are at assembly lines or they're places that take minimal skills. But there's nothing, I'm not diminishing people that have minimum wage jobs. It's just people that are entry level into the workforce. So let's play this hypothetical example. Let's say I own a restaurant and we make burgers. It's called Charlie's Burger Palace, okay? And we're doing great business and the minimum wage in the state that I live in, let's say, is $10. Let's just say it's even numbers. And I have 3 employees and they're all working on similar tasks, but they have different outputs. So employee A, still learning, entry-level employee, is a high school student, really trying to make something of himself. He's only able to flip 5 burgers a minute. Okay, he's learning. Then I have employee B, he's able to flip 10 burgers a minute, better. But then I have employee C. Employee C is phenomenal, 15 burgers a minute. So I have 3 different buckets of productivity. And so, but I'm all paying them the same for now because they're all entry-level and they're still getting the ropes, but employee C has a really good future. But if a minimum wage hike comes and I have to now pay them more, but I can't really afford it, who do I let go first? Well, I let go of employee A first, of course. Well, who is employee A? I just told you who employee A was. He's a high school student. He needs the job. He'll get the most out of the job and the most skills necessary. If I let go of employee C, because he's flipping 15 burgers an hour, he'll be able to go find another job across town at Wendy's or Burger King or Sonic or any of these other kind of burger chains. And by the way, employee C needs the wage hike the least. The most skilled employees, the most productive employees, the people that are the highest echelon of the workforce output actually need the wage hike the least. So what does the wage hike actually do? Well, employee C was going to get a raise anyway. I was planning on giving employee C a raise and a promotion in a couple weeks if he continued to do a 15-burger type output and kept on hustling. He was well on his way to get his wage hike, to get a wage increase. He didn't need the government to do it for him. All that it did was penalize the person at the lowest level of the economic ladder. I actually talked about this on Martha McCallum's show not too long ago. We did this in a past podcast. I want to do this again because I actually think it demonstrates the point really well. Let's cut to the sound of my explanation of the minimum wage and its failure to actually serve the needs and wants of middle class and lower class workers on my friend Martha McCallum's show on Fox News. Play sound.
The numbers, when you actually look at raising minimum wage, it might feel good and sound good, but really we've seen what happened in New York City. 75% of restaurants have had to cut hours and cut back staff because of a raise in the minimum wage. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that 3.7 million jobs would be lost if the federal minimum wage went up to $15 an hour, let alone $20 an hour. And not to mention, prices just go up. It's the consumer that ends up having to pay more, and then it's the middle class and lower class workers, entry-level positions, that get cut when you raise the minimum wage. And it's a burden on the middle class and the lower middle class workers.
So, in essence, arbitrary minimum wage hikes actually hurts the people that they're designed to help the most. And we know this because as we have raised the minimum wage significantly over the last 25 years, the rich have gotten richer, and the areas that have had these wage hikes have actually seen themselves living in a permanent system of poverty, or a permanent status of poverty, if you will. I mean, the poor have not seen their general standard of living dramatically increase because of arbitrary minimum wage hikes. And especially if you're trying to raise a minimum wage outside of the rates of inflation, you're just going to raise prices. You're just going to raise prices on the very same people that are then trying to buy the goods and services. So let's say that, let's play a hypothetical, minimum wage actually didn't make any jobs disappear, which is not true, or any diminishment of hours. All of a sudden, all the prices are going to be raised, and it's going to be effectively no impact. I mean, you're essentially going to see all these people that have higher wages, but everything they're going to buy, an apple will go from $1 to $2, their dollars actually travel less. We've talked about this before on the Charlie Kirk Show. Inflation serves the needs and wants and desires of the rich. Inflation hurts poor people the most. Think about it. Is it the rich that are actually dealing mostly in cash? No, the rich are the ones that own assets. The rich are the ones that own stocks and bonds. When you have inflation, it helps people that are able to actually own things that appreciate in value. If you're renting and you're borrowing, inflation kills you. And things that contribute to inflation, the creation of cheap money, the deterioration of any sort of metallic-based currency, which we've seen, reckless government spending, and also artificial wage hikes. These are things that contribute to inflation. Upper middle class individuals, they're able to take a hit of inflation so much easier because they own assets and they're able to ride the wave of inflation. People that, it's the old thing. So who is more likely to put cash under their bed? Who's more likely to put cash under their bed and save it for future, put cash in a shoebox? Someone who lives in Beverly Hills or someone who lives in Compton? Well, the person who lives in Compton, they're trying to save away. They're dealing in cash or dealing in tips. Well, what makes that cash worth less is when inflation happens in society. That's what actually makes that cash worth less. Person in Beverly Hills couldn't care less. They're like, yeah, I have stocks and bonds. I have a money manager for this type of stuff. We're able to ride the wave of inflation really, really effectively. And that is what happens when you have minimum wage. You have the lower and middle class income earners actually disenfranchised more times than not. Let's talk about football. Football is back. There were some great games in college football this last weekend. Sorry for all the University of Texas fans out there. There was a great weekend of NFL football as well. I mean, I love the New England Patriots. I love Tom Brady.
I always have. It's just kind of getting a little unfair, so I hope that some team can rise up and give them a run for their money. And so we got some big matchups. Got Minnesota at Green Bay, Kansas City at Oakland, Seattle at Pittsburgh this weekend, New Orleans at LA. I love New Orleans to pull off the upset there. So get in on the action right now. For those of you that want to actually get engaged, get involved, and you have your own opinions of who you think is going to win, then you got to visit betonline.ag. And don't forget that promo code podcast1 for your 50% sign-up bonus. BetOnline.ag is the place to do it. Of course, Adam Carolla thinks he can pick games better than I can. Well, look, we have this $5,000 season-long charity contest, so you got to get in on the action. So here's a look. Here are my five picks of the week. Here we go. Minnesota-Green Bay, I like Minnesota to pull it off. Kansas City at Oakland, I like Kansas City. Seattle at Pittsburgh, I like Seattle. New Orleans at LA Rams, I like New Orleans. And Philadelphia at Atlanta, I like Philadelphia. Those are my picks for the week. And for those of you that might disagree, well, then put some money on it. Go to betonline.ag. Let's see for yourself. Let's see you put your money where your mouth is. Then you got to visit betonline.ag. And don't forget that promo code podcast1 for your 50% sign-up bonus. That is betonline.ag.
What's the next question, Mr. Producer?
Question for Charlie. What is the proper response to UBI? Universal basic income.
Proper response to UBI. Okay, so I hate using acronyms without explaining what they are. UBI is universal basic income. This is getting a lot of attention by the provocateur, Andrew Yang, the Yang Gang. I actually have a prediction that Andrew Yang will be a libertarian in a couple years. So let's go through what his whole thing is, that he's going to give what? An $1,000 freedom dividend is what he calls it. He's going to give a $1,000 freedom dividend to every man, woman, child of this great country, despite their income level. So Bill Gates is even getting $1,000 a month. I think there might be some exception for Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos. I don't think they'll actually, you know, feel $1,000 a month. But the whole Andrew Yang premise and the whole UBI premise is that the machines are advancing way too quickly. Productivity gains are widening, not shrinking. And the only way that he's going to be able to compensate for that is to be able to tax that kind of productivity gains through companies like Amazon and Facebook and these massive transnational corporations and redistribute that in the form of a $1,000 freedom dividend to every man, woman, and child. And this is the idea of universal basic income, essentially cash-based redistribution. So actually, this idea was originally floated under a different term. It was called a negative income tax. It was floated under the great Milton Friedman, the free market thinker from the University of Chicago, who won a Nobel Peace Prize and essentially built the entire Chilean economy, which is the best economy in South America, most stable, most prosperous, most free economy, around the ideas of free market principles. And so Milton Friedman would actually pose this theory. He said, I will support adding up all the costs and all of the output of the welfare state. So if you actually add it up right now, it's about, in today's terms, $50,000 per individual that receives welfare. And I will give them a $50,000 check a year for them to spend however they see fit. Now, actually, this would save the taxpayer money because it would save the money and all the bureaucracy and all the lack of oversight and all the institutions and all the Department of Welfare that we have. It would eliminate all that. So it would actually save the taxpayer hundreds of billions of dollars a year if we just gave cash to citizens. And Milton Friedman said, I would take this trade in a second. Now, Milton Friedman's argument was that it would actually incentivize the recipient to be more frugal, to be more careful, and to be more responsible with the money that they're actually receiving. So let's say that there's an individual that really needs welfare and they need housing and urban development. You get rid of all of that. No food stamps, no Medicaid, no housing and urban development, none of that. You just get a check. Now, if you spend all that money, sorry, that's up for you to actually siphon it off, to invest, to spend however you see fit. I'm actually very sympathetic to this argument. However, it's totally and completely unrealistic. This will never happen. To dissemble the welfare state is just as utopian to believe that you can get rid of the ills and wants. I mean, I hate to sound pessimistic here. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to disassemble a million civil servants where their job is literally to give out free stuff all the time. It's just not going to happen. It is more realistic, unfortunately, that Andrew Yang can go past something to give more free stuff away. So it's actually not as simple as he makes it seem. The way that DC works, like, oh, great idea, Mr. Yang. Let's create a whole new department around this. The Department of Free Stuff or the Department of UBI. You can just see it happening right now. The Department of Universal Basic Income. And you'll have all these tens of thousands of useless people. Now, they're actually not useless people, but they're useless positions. Let's put it that way. Useless positions staffed by nice people, I guess, that will then give the stuff away and do nothing all day long. So there'll be an added cost. So it won't be $1,000. It'll be $1,000 given away and $1,000 per person it will cost to actually run the damn thing every single day, every single year. Let me tell you why this is a bad idea. And I actually pose this idea to Andrew Yang right now. Andrew Yang, Instead of saying you're gonna give $1,000 to every single person, why don't you say you're gonna give $1,000 tax cut per month to every single person? Instead of saying I'm gonna give you something, just say I'm gonna get rid of the FICA tax for the middle class. The FICA tax is a 7% tax annually on work, on every single worker. Just say I'm gonna get rid of that. All of a sudden, you're giving people money. It's the same thing functionally, but you don't have to redistribute it. You don't have to tax productivity. Why are you opposed to that? Why are you just trying to say, I'm going to give someone something for free that somebody else has? Just give more people more of their own money. This is the solution to UBI. This is the libertarian conservative solution to UBI, something that I totally support. I think Republicans should run in 2020. I think President Trump should run in 2020 on a middle-class tax cut so that anybody earning $55,000 or $60,000, you can find the right number, run the numbers on it. Anybody earning $50,000 or less a year pays nothing in FICA taxes. It's a 7% tax. Oh my goodness, you're talking about a workers' tax cut. Yes, I actually think that in response to these attacks that Republicans and conservatives don't care about workers, we would give a tax cut for teachers, it'd be a tax cut for firefighters, it'd be a tax cut for police officers, a tax cut for carpenters. We would then give more money to the middle class that we are accused of disenfranchising constantly and completely. This would totally, this would eliminate the argument of Andrew Yang. His whole argument is, well, we have to help people that are working and they don't have, well, actually it's deeper than that. He thinks that people shouldn't be working. And that's the whole thing. And then he makes the first, well, people have more time to spend on art, and really $1,000 is enough to go spend more free time on some weird stuff. Instead of giving $1,000 to people and stuff, give them $1,000 of their own money back instead of stealing it under the guise of FICA and the federal government. Instead of giving you $12,000 a year of other people's stuff, I will give you $12,000 a year of your own stuff. Cut your own taxes so you can keep the money that you're already earning, that you're already waking up early to get, that you're already working extra hours to get, that you're already pushing yourself to get. I would allow you to keep the wage that you work so hard to receive instead of taking it from somebody else and giving you free stuff. That's not the correct thing to do. That doesn't make sense economically. Instead, I want your hard work to be paid off. Police officers, firefighters, teachers, middle-class workers, construction workers, that 7% that you see disappear in your paycheck, I want all that 7% to go back to you immediately, instantaneously. Andrew Yang, I would love your thoughts in response to this, because there's no way not to support a $1,000 a month tax cut on workers that are already seeing their wages disappear because of what I believe an unethical and immoral tax on those that work the hardest in our society that need the money the most. And by the way, going back to our whole episode on how to become president of the United States, those who win the middle class, those who work, those who win the individuals that shower before work and after work, which I thought was one of the best lines of the Democrat debate, I will give credit. Whoever wins those people will win the White House. So whatever party actually runs on an elimination of the FICA tax, which is a 7% tax on work, and if you're watching this video or listening to this podcast, you are paying this tax. If you are working, they're taking your money on an hourly wage. And guess what? That is a regressive tax. If you're working at Goldman Sachs, you could take that 7% hit. If you're working at Chase Bank, you're working at Wells Fargo, but if you're working hour to hour and you're working paycheck to paycheck, you deserve that extra money every single month to eliminate the FICA tax. And maybe just eliminate it just to a cent where you get $1,000 a month. This is a direct response to Andrew Yang's ploy to give free stuff to people. In reality, you should be able to keep your own stuff. And this is actually the best political strategy. Whatever political party runs on this will win the White House. Mr. Producer, next question.
Question from Smart Guy. Question, what is the best solution to the debt?
Well, look, the debt is, our rising national debt is one of the greatest threats to our future as a country, our national sovereignty, our national security, so on and so forth. When I first started Turning Point USA, the national debt was $13 trillion. Now it's $22 trillion. Feckless politicians and both political parties have screwed up our country so miserably we have grown accustomed to $700 billion deficits every single year. So let's just first talk about terms. There's a difference between deficits and debt. A deficit is your annual bleed, your annual amount that you borrow every single year. The debt is a cumulative debt burden that your country actually owes. And then there's unfunded liabilities, which we'll talk about in a second, which is the third category, which is the promises that you've made in the future, which far exceeds all of that. So the deficit this year is on pace to be anywhere between $800 billion and $900 billion a year. We were rioting in the streets when Obama borrowed that kind of money. This is unacceptable. This is immoral. And people in both political parties have allowed this to happen far too long. President Trump has stood up to this, and he has been overridden by weak-kneed Republicans in the United States Senate and Congress that feel perfectly fine with borrowing our future away. Make no mistake, every dollar that Washington borrows is one of two things in the future. It's a tax increase or it's inflation. There's only one way that you can get out of the debt burden that we have, and that's to inflate your way out of it. We are $22 trillion in debt right now. This is a massive, massive problem. The only way to solve this is to cut spending. It's the only way. First and foremost, you have to solve entitlements. You have the AARP, which is the American Association of Retired People, which is one of the most destructive lobbies in Washington, D.C. Anytime you even float the idea of reforming Social Security, such as raising the retirement age, which we should do, or eliminating waste, fraud, abuse in Medicare, which we should do, or maybe peeling back Medicare Part D, which we should do, which was passed under George W. Bush, which never should have been passed, they mobilize their lobbyists and it gets killed instantaneously. The Social Security retirement age has not been raised since Social Security was passed in the 1930s, despite life expectancy going up dramatically. Life expectancy in the United States is 80 for women, 78 for men. That has been raised dramatically from when Social Security was passed in the 1930s under Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I actually believe that our generation should not be forced to pay into something that will not exist. Social Security will go bankrupt anywhere between the next 5 to 10 years. We will be running a deficit in Social Security very soon. And yes, people do live off of Social Security. I actually have this radical idea that we can fix Social Security for future generations by allowing you to opt out of Social Security. I want to sign somewhere where I say, I don't have to pay Social Security tax. I'll take care of myself by the time I get to be 65. I don't need the government taking my money and telling me how to best live my life. I just don't. And for future retirees and future beneficiaries, fine. You can keep your own money. That's great. I actually have another radical idea. If your income and wealth levels are above $500,000, so if you have cumulative wealth minus debt, so if you actually take the amount of wealth you have, you subtract debt and it's above $500,000, you should not receive Social Security. Sorry, you're doing well enough. You were taxed, you're not going to see that money. That will help balance Social Security. And by the way, a lot of conservatives and Republicans refuse to say this. This is something that the left would always say, which is that rich people shouldn't get Social Security. I actually fundamentally agree with this. I totally agree. I think it's a common sense proposal. And so the other thing is this. So the national budget is comprised and composed in a lot of different buckets. First of all, you have entitlements, which is Medicare and Social Security. These are the massive drivers of the debt. But then we as Republicans and conservatives never talk about the Department of Defense. We never talk about the endless and reckless wars overseas. We never talk about the permanent military occupations that drive our national debt. We are so close to examine the waste, fraud, and abuse in every single department, which we should, and there is an abundant. Right now, we could cut 20% of the federal government and not even feel the impact whatsoever. We need severe and we need dramatic cuts in our federal budget right now. We should basically eliminate the Department of Education and block grant whatever funds are left over to the states. We do not need tens of thousands of permanent federal bureaucrats doing nothing in the Department of Education all day long. That you can eliminate. The Department of Energy, which is basically just looking at nuclear power plants all day long, you can minimize that by 60%. Not to mention, I could go piece by piece by piece. Department of Interior, we should sell most of the Western lands. Sell them back to the states. Sell them back to the people. The Department of Interior is full of waste, full of abuse. There should be user fees. Department of Transportation, institute more tolls. That's right, institute more tolls and scale back the Department of Transportation. Department of Health and Human Services, there's so much waste in Medicaid, Medicare, so on and so forth. So here's one way to do it. Here's one way to solve the debt. Give a bonus to any federal bureaucrat that saves a multiple of what the amount of bonus would be. So give someone a $1,000 bonus for every $1 million they save. You could balance the budget in the afternoon. Everyone will be running around. Oh, I know where the waste is. Incentivize the bureaucrats to find the waste and give their money to go do it. You should minimize the workforce with a totally complete federal hiring freeze and then be able to fire civil servants. The fact we cannot fire civil servants is a tragedy. It's a crisis. We have this permanent bureaucracy that runs around Washington, D.C., and they don't even know what they do all day long. There's waste in the Department of Justice. There's waste in the Department of Defense. There's waste in the Department of Energy. There's waste in the Department of Health and Human Services. There's waste in the Department of Agriculture. There's waste all across it. We should call for a true federal hiring freeze and 20% elimination of the permanent federal bureaucracy. In the Department of Defense, audit the Department of Defense. And I believe the precursor to all this is the beginning. And again, no, very few politicians actually talk like this because they want to get reelected and they want to make friends. I'm not in the business of making friends in Washington, D.C. I'm just going to tell it to you straight. There's waste, fraud, and abuse in the Pentagon in ways that no one could possibly imagine. But under the auspices of national security, we never actually talk about it. We don't need Tomahawk missiles that cost as much as they do. Yes, I want national security. Open up the bidding. There are other companies in the world that could potentially develop Tomahawk missiles other than Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. There are other people that build airplanes other than Boeing. They're not the only company that understands how to build an airplane. We're a country of 330 million people. We're the wealthiest country ever to exist. We're stuck in this ridiculous cycle that only Boeing could build airplanes. Really? Like, really? That's what we've come to? that we have all these amazing entrepreneurs. We have 18 out of 20 of the top research institutions in the world. We have the smartest people. We have capital flowing everywhere. We have entrepreneurs that are coming up to me, people with money. Hey, Charlie, you know any good deals to invest in? I'm like, yeah, I guess I do. I mean, we have so much wealth that has been created in the Trump economy. You're trying to tell me that a competitor Boeing cannot be created in 6 months, but instead we have these hyperinflated government contracts because they have proximity to Washington, D.C., and the lobbyists to be able to push for them. Okay, so here's my solution. Number one, no one in Washington, D.C. should ever be paid unless there's a balanced budget, a true balanced budget. Rescind their pay. No one gets paid. No one gets paid. Anyone in government should not be paid except mandatory parts of the government, such as the military. Just, or people that maybe monitor nuclear sites, make sure they don't overflow. No one gets paid unless the federal budget is actually balanced, including, first and foremost, the politicians. Those 535 self-interested politicians that run around Washington, D.C. with a few exceptions, they should not be paid unless the federal budget is balanced. Number two, this is a new idea on the Charlie Kirk Show. We should put every single dime of federal spending online in real time. Audit the federal budget, put it online. I want to know if the head of Department of Interior is going to Capitol Grill, or is it going to Foga to Chow, and I want to see the receipts. I want to see it down to the type of pencils that they're buying. I want to see every single receipt, because I'm telling you right now, transparency leads to reform. The more we know about where the waste, fraud, and abuse is going, and the more the people see it, the more grassroots change that would be demanded to actually cut the spending. Every dime of federal spending online in real time. I want to audit the federal budget going as back as far as it can go. You can do this basically for a couple $100 million. Guess what, Ernst & Young? You've made so much money the last couple years. We're going to hire you. Go audit the federal budget. Go send your accountants that are always investigating everything else. Go give the contract to the Big Five. Go investigate the federal budget. I want to know where the money's going. I want to know the restaurants they're eating at. I want to know the things that they're expensing. I've been told by numerous, countless federal employees that their budgets are so big and they're forced to spend them by the end of the year. They go on these reckless furniture spending sprees. In fact, they laugh. Our federal employees are laughing at our tax dollars that are being spent in our own federal bureaucracies that they run up the bill on towards the end of the year. And it's no laughing matter. Our national debt is such a massive issue. So anyway, you have to have a balanced budget amendment slash do not pay anyone except mandatory federal employees. By the way, you know, can I just say as a side note, every time there's a government shutdown, do you notice every time there's a government shutdown, they say, well, all non-mandatory employees are going to be furloughed. If they're not mandatory, why do they have jobs? Do you notice that the government works just fine when all these people go home? Fire all of them. That's right. Fire them. Go find something else to do. If you're not a mandatory employee, go find a job in the private sector. All of them. We should fire about 1 million federal employees. Not because they're not good people, but guess what? They create liabilities for a living. Our government is so big. So big. Our federal budget is about $4.4 trillion this year. We will bring in revenue more or less about $3.5 trillion. What if we only spent as much as we brought in? Could we get our federal budget to $3.5 trillion? Of course we could. We could, but we don't want to because we have spineless, lack of courageous politicians that do not do the correct work to find where the waste is, identify it, slash it, expose it. And that also goes back to term limits. We don't have people that are actually properly incentivized to actually go find the reform. So how do we solve the debt? Boy, I think here's the last thing we should do. I think President Trump, post-presidency, should be appointed as the director of finding waste. And he should just be like a roaming czar to just go fire people and find waste in the federal government. But really, the big thing is this. We should audit the federal government, put every single dime of federal spending online in real time. So just how we do at Turning Point USA, if one of my employees, we go through every single expenditure at Turning Point USA, every single credit card statement gets looked at and gets put to the board. Who's the board of a federal government? The U.S. taxpayer. If you're listening to this, you're a board member of the federal government, so you deserve to see every receipt. Upload the receipt immediately if you work at the Department of Transportation after you go on some sort of trip to Paraguay for God knows whatever reason. I want to know why. I want to know the justification of it. I want to know if you bought a water bottle, if you expensed it. I want to know everything. And then I want to know sunlight is the greatest disinfectant. That's the only thing that will solve this thing. Because I want to see why they're wasting the money and where the money's going. I guarantee you we'll be able to fester it out. I'll give you two quick examples. In Afghanistan alone, we built a $90 million. Actually, we had this clip on Senator Rand Paul. Let's cut to this clip right now. He can say it a lot better than I can. Of a $90 million hotel that we built in Afghanistan that we now have to tear down, that was never used, just the shell, because then it became a terrorist encampment. We're going to cut to our interview with Senator Rand Paul. And if you've heard this before, you'll hear it again. Repetition is the soul of memory. Enjoy this clip of Senator Rand Paul, where he explains some of the waste, fraud, and abuse in Afghanistan.
We spent something like $90 million on a hotel across the street from our embassy that has 7,000 people in it. The hotel's not finished. The shell of a hotel. and someone ran with the money to Jordan or something. They fled.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And then it's out to Taliban outpost where they shoot down at our embassy.
And
now we have to deconstruct.
And you know what the conclusion is going to be to this hotel? We're going to spend another couple hundred thousand to tear it down because it's a danger to our soldiers. So but some guy got $90 million and ran off with it. There's another example from Afghanistan. They wanted to build a gas station for the Afghans. See, it's not about war. It's about building stuff for them. So, but because we're going green in the military, it's a natural gas station. How many people have a car in the audience that runs on natural gas? Nobody in America has a car that runs on natural gas. They're extraordinary if they exist. Nobody in Afghanistan even has a car. The average income is $800 a year. So nobody's got a car. They're burning campfires, all right? And so we built them a natural gas station. They had no cars, so we bought them some cars. We bought them 24 cars that run on natural gas, but they had no money, so we gave them a credit card to get the gas. But the gas station was supposed to cost about $500,000. It ended up costing $45 million because the contractors were ripping us off. So I had two members of my staff that said they'd go to Afghanistan to look at some of this waste. They got over there, and after 19 years, you can't drive in a car anywhere. You have to go by helicopter with Marines to protect you, even within the city of Kabul, the capital. So the gas station was out in the country, and they said, can we see it to see if it is functioning? What's a $45 million natural gas station doing? And they said, well, we just can't take the risk to go out there. It's not worth Americans dying to show you this gas station. So it's like we spent $45 million in an area of the country we can't even visit. See, this is crazy. No kids should be sent over to Afghanistan when there is no reason for the war anymore. We're building them gas stations and roads.
So I hope you enjoyed that clip of Senator Rand Paul talking about some of the waste, fraud, and abuse just in Afghanistan. That was an exclusive interview. We have some of the best guests you can imagine. I hope you really enjoy that. Mr. Producer just gave me a really interesting statistic. Just in Social Security output, in 1945, there was 41.9 workers for every beneficiary of Social Security. Now there is 2.9 for every one worker. And in, 2030, there'll be two workers for every one beneficiary. This is an unsustainable model. And the amount of if you're receiving Social Security over a certain income level, you should have your Social Security completely sacrificed and foregone. And if you are under, and if you are a future retiree, raise the retirement age. Raise the retirement age. It's so simple. It's so easy.
I want to talk about our amazing and terrific friends at Vincero. Vincero watches create exceptionally crafted watches and sell them at a fair price. By focusing on meticulous quality control and small batch manufacturing, Vincero has established themselves as the best value in the entire industry. You're not going to find a better made watch for this good of a price anywhere else. There's a reason why Vincero has 16,000 five-star reviews, because their bold timepieces masterfully blend form and function into one affordable timepiece. Just for my listeners, Vincero is offering 15% off your entire order with the code KIRK, K-I-R-K. Just head to VinceroWatches.com and use the code KIRK for 15% off. For daily wear, special occasions, or around the office, a classic wristwatch is something every man needs. Vincero timepieces are bold, uncompromising showstoppers that can match any outfit. Vincero just dropped their new Altitude collection, and all we have to say is, wow, it's totally amazing. The Altitude features a 43-millimeter case, a dual time function, luminous hands and numbers, and a water resistance up to 10 ATM. It's a watch with a modern look and a totally amazing functionality of a traditional pilot watch. Look, again, go to VinceroWatches.com, V-I-N-C-E-R-O, watches.com. Use the code K-I-R-K for 15% off your entire order.
Mr. Producer, next question.
Charlie, could you talk about your views on China and the ways that they are or could become a national threat?
Sure. So for those of you that follow my work really closely, I am very, very worried about the rise of China. So first and foremost, this is the important distinction to make. There's a difference between China and the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party is evil, they are secular, and they are on a steady rampage to destroy Western civilization. China as a culture is a beautiful, rich culture. Confucianism, the many dynasties, the art and the literature. China as a people is different than the Chinese Communist Party, the ruling class over China. So China right now has Muslims in concentration camps. They're trying to create artificial intelligence to control all 1.2 billion of their citizens. They are a fast-growing economy, about half of our GDP, about $10 to $11 trillion in GDP. They have more debt than people actually realize, so keep an eye on that. Thanks to President Trump's tariffs, their growth has actually slowed totally. They are buying up natural mineral rights all over sub-Saharan Africa. They're buying up ports of entry all over South America. They have said many times internally that they want to expand their influence all across Asia. If you go to Vietnam right now, the only thing they're worried about is China. They couldn't care less about the Vietnam War back in the 60s. All they care about is the rise of China. China is so solely focused on growing their influence and diminishing ours that they have gone to lengths of hacking our cybersecurity grid. They have built the Confucius Institutes all over our college campuses, which are basically paramilitary operations to spy on American citizens and to essentially create a spy network on college campuses. And I know that might sound a little extreme, but I encourage you to look up what Christopher Wray said in his Senate testimony, where he said that the Confucius Institutes pose a significant national security risk against America and against the United States. But also, the Confucius Institutes are indoctrinating American students to think more affectionately towards the rise of China. So look, China is America's greatest enemy. China is our greatest geopolitical foe. I go as far to call them as an enemy, because friends or allies or foes don't just steal intellectual property. They don't hack cyber grids. They don't have plans to take over Western civilization. They're building a massive standing army. They're building islands in Southeast Asia. And people like Joe Biden, who are so soft on China, who have benefited from China, whose son actually has raised money from China, are completely and totally wrong. They don't understand that the determination of the Chinese Communist Party is the total elimination of our way of life, and is a takeover and a new geopolitical status quo where there's Chinese supremacy. And they're making many different moves towards this. Now, China has a lot of problems. China does not have a middle class like America. China is highly suppressive of their citizens. China is highly regressive in the way that they view religious liberty. They do not have freedom of expression whatsoever. China is very controlling of their citizens. And also, China has an energy problem. China is not blessed with the same amount of natural resources and energy as the United States. So they're highly, highly reliant on Middle Eastern oil from Iran and from OPEC trading countries. And they also have a massive population. The thing that worries the Chinese Communist Party most is a citizen uprising. They are worried most about a citizen uprising. In China, you worry most about the three T's, the three T's you are not allowed to mention. That is Taiwan, that is Tibet, and most importantly, Tiananmen Square. Tibet is the illegal annexation of a sovereign country in Tibet, of which they believe they control, which they have no rights over. Taiwan, they believe that Taiwan is theirs. Taiwan should be a free country, and we should stand with the free Taiwanese people against Chinese totalitarianism. And finally, Tiananmen Square, which many of you might know. Tiananmen Square was a citizen uprising of mostly college students that put forth some reforms that are now being rolled back against the Chinese Communist Party. Now, the Chinese Communists took power in the late 1920s, early 1930s, part of a huge movement that was, of course, around Mao. Maoism, which resulted in the death of over, anywhere estimates are between 50 to 70 million people that were killed under Chinese Communist power, and which now has led to China. But China's real, the reason why China's been able to get rich so quickly is when Nixon opened China in the 1970s, and he was able to open up the West to China, which essentially China had a 40-year plan, which is now coming to fruition, where they have to undercut U.S. manufacturing, be able to make goods cheaper than us, steal our ideas, and then re-implement and then dump those products into the West. I think that's finally coming to a head right now. We've realized the damage that those deals and the opening of China has done to our country. Not to mention, we have shipped over 10 million manufacturing jobs to China, which has disenfranchised our communities, which has led to the rise of opioids and the rise in suicides and depression rates all amongst the West. It is time to get tough on China, and I totally, completely support the president doing so with tariffs and with essentially calling out China for the BS that they've done to the Western world. We have not had free trade with China. We've had pro-China trade, and we have made China really, really rich, and we've gotten somewhat richer because of it, but not all of our communities have gotten richer because of it. We have seen certain areas of America get rich, while others have been completely and totally deteriorated. But keep an eye on China's debt. China is racking up debt quicker than you might ever imagine, and that's not talked about a lot, and any slowdown in the Chinese economic projections will mean massive recession, and China's going through a recession right now, and any furthering of that could lead to huge civil unrest and huge kind of civilian uncertainty, which is the biggest potential threat to the Chinese Communist Party. To kind of just make a really quick point of correction, China is not technically in a recession. They're in an economic slowdown, which, again, the technical economic definition of a recession is a contraction of an economy, but they're in a huge slowdown. By the way, I actually think they're in a recession because their numbers have been BS for years. They build ghost cities that have no one in there, and I think they've been boosting their economic numbers, the world community, for quite some time. But again, we, as President Trump always says, we'll see what happens. You can see a citizen uprising happening in Hong Kong, which I totally support. I stand with the people of Hong Kong standing up against the totalitarian dictators and leaders. His name is Xi Jinping, who has tried to assume himself to become the new Mao of China. Now, look, China's entire model is essentially built around the West not waking up to their entire takeover. And the Chinese citizen, we have to turn the focus of the Chinese citizens toward their government to demand true freedom, to demand personal freedom, economic freedom, religious freedom, something that we in America should never, ever take for granted. Okay, Mr. Producer, what's the next question?
In response to our No War with Iran episode, hi, Charlie. To say I love your show is an understatement. I'm married to a Persian American. If the U.S. doesn't need to depend on anyone for oil, why are we so chummy with Saudi Arabia after their dark history? Thanks. P.S. Does Mr. Producer have a name?
Mr. Producer does have a name. I just don't know if Mr. Producer wants to share his name.
Mr. Andrew.
So look, I kind of take the Rand Paul doctrine on the observation of the Middle East. I don't think any of them except Israel are good actors. And I've said this once and I'll say this again. I'm highly critical of Iran, but I'm also critical of Saudi Arabia. I just don't understand this inside-out relationship that we have with Saudi Arabia. Look, Saudi Arabia, 15 out of 19 of the hijackers in 9/11 were Saudi Arabian. They're the number one funder of Wahhabism, which is the most extreme form of Islam across the world, which the most amount of violent terror stems out of. They're still building madrasas all across Pakistan and all across Indonesia that have the most fundamentalist, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti-Western, anti-American imams stem from. Saudi Arabia, look, the bin Laden family was from Saudi Arabia. I mean, Osama bin Laden was Saudi. And some say that there are reforms happening in Saudi Arabia, but they're still publicly executing people in the streets. They still have this medieval Wahhabist ideology that is stemming throughout their entire country. And I have made the point that, yes, Iran is the number one funder of terror in the world, but that doesn't justify an inside-out relationship or a close relationship with Saudi Arabia. We should not sell arms to Saudi Arabia. We just shouldn't. We should not sell weapons to countries that are close to groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. In fact, we should totally cut our arms deals with Saudi Arabia. And I believe that we're stuck in the bigotry of binary choices, that you're either totally against Iran, and therefore you're for Saudi Arabia, or you're totally in favor of Iran, which was the left want. They want to cart hundreds of billions of dollars to Iran and send billions in cash to them, and they're against Saudi Arabia. Just so everyone realizes, in my position on this, we should put our country first, and we should not get involved in 1,500-year-old conflicts in the Middle East between the two big regional powers. Basically, everything in the Middle East can be boiled down to Shia versus Sunni. And again, that's an oversimplification because there's lots of different mini-sects underneath that, such as I just mentioned Wahhabism. But Saudi Arabia is Sunni Muslim. Iran is Shia Muslim. They are never going to get along, ever. This goes back hundreds of years before the formation of America. Saudi Arabia hates Iran. Iran hates Saudi Arabia. They have been at war with each other for quite some time. And so, but in the 1950s, the West, mainly America and Britain, made a deal with Saudi Arabia and made a deal that, hey, we're gonna allow you to get some oil profits here, but we're gonna kind of protect some of your medieval radicalism. That has gone out of control in the last couple of decades. Now, Britain used to control Iranian oil, and the difference between what happened and what led to the Iranian Revolution was that in Saudi Arabia, the United States is able to broker a much more warm and friendly relationship with the Saud family. Where do you think the name Saudi Arabia comes from? The Saud family, King Saud. Where in Iran, Iran tried to nationalize their oil in the 1950s and did so successfully through Mossadegh, and we overthrew him. We just overthrew him. The CIA did, the Central Intelligence Agency, and we put the Shah back in power. Big mistake. So to answer the question is, look, we shouldn't have this kind of chummy relationship with Saudi Arabia. I'm not saying we declare war on them or anything like that, but we shouldn't sell weapons to them because there's been evidence that we sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, as Senator Rand Paul says, those weapons will end up in the hands of countries that fundamentally hate us. Or not just countries, into groups that fundamentally hate us, like Al-Qaeda or ISIS. There's been tons of studies that show that. We also shouldn't sell arms to Iran. And look, we are energy independent as a country. We are exporting more oil than we're importing. We don't need Saudi Arabia. We don't need Iran. We do not need the Middle East anymore. An American first posture is one that will get out of these endless reckless wars before we engage with them in the Middle East. And one other just kind of really interesting side note. So one of the most stunning clips that I've seen is a Netflix documentary with Donald Rumsfeld. And Donald Rumsfeld personally recounts, it's not a third party reflection, this is him personally talking about how he went into a meeting with Vice President Dick Cheney and the ambassador of Saudi Arabia, and they began floating out the idea of invading the sovereign country, Iraq, and toppling Saddam Hussein. The Iraq War, was one of the worst mistakes in American foreign policy history. So understand that our relationship with Saudi Arabia needs to be vastly reconsidered. And this is coming from someone who believes that I'm not, as some people on the left, where they think we need to be warmer to Iran. I don't believe that whatsoever. I believe that there is mutual hatred for the West that stems from these radical Islamic medieval theocratic dictatorships. Ask yourself the question, why the ambassador to Saudi Arabia would be meeting with an American vice president about the potential invasion of a country, of Iraq, and toppling Saddam Hussein with the head of Department of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, coming into that meeting. This makes no sense. And I have been firm against ending these endless wars in the Middle East. That means ending this perpetual nonsensical war in Afghanistan. That means, yes, admitting that the Middle East is a basket case that does not serve America's interests. We are energy independent as a country. We do not need to be perpetually in these war games that result in massive casualties, massive debt. And going back to the earlier question, how do we solve our debt? How about we just end these stupid wars in the Middle East? We spent trillions of dollars in a country that most Americans can't find on a map, will never visit, and have no effect to our livelihood. And now we're in debt to have to pay for what? Roads, bridges, and schools that don't even work, that do not serve the national interest to our own country. And I agree completely with Senator Rand Paul on this topic. And I've really taken Senator Rand Paul as kind of a guiding force and a shining light that we should not sell weapons to Saudi Arabia, and we should vastly reconsider our relationship with Saudi Arabia. And I'll say one last thing on this. And again, this is something where I think we should be intense on Iran, too. I don't believe in this bigotry of binary choices that we have to either be pro-Iran or pro-Saudi Arabia. So like the Obama administration was anti-Saudi Arabia, but much more sympathetic to Iran. And you want to talk about how you should fund the victims of 9/11 fund? Why don't we go after Saudi Arabia, having 15 out of 19 of the hijackers that came from Saudi Arabia? You're trying to tell me the Saudi Arabian government didn't know anything about that? So from the listener that was listening to the No War with Iran podcast, I appreciate the question. And I just want to say that posture that I personally have with the Middle East is I'm sick and tired of American servicemen and women going to fight endless wars, going to fight for other causes that have nothing to do with our own country, where we're $22 trillion in debt, while we have veterans with PTSD, we have a veteran suicide crisis. It does not make any sense. And look, part of the question was that married to a Persian American. I had a lot of friends growing up that were Iranian. I had a lot of friends from Saudi Arabia that fled in exile and believed that both countries lived in totalitarian regimes. My Uber driver yesterday basically was kicked out of Saudi Arabia and has no love lost for Mohammed bin Salman, or the head of Iran. And so look, the people of Saudi Arabia and the people of Iran, we're for you. We are for reformation. We are for progressive reform. Yes, I'm using that word. Because we are for actual change in your country that will push back against these medieval theocratic dictatorships that continue to oppress your citizens. And this is the good thing for the world. This is the good thing for America. And so the Persian people are some of the smartest, most entrepreneurial, most ethical, amazing people. And there is a difference between the history of Persia and modern day Iran. Most of Persia, believe it or not, operated outside of the influence of Islam. Most of Persia was not an Islamic history. Most of Persia was a history based on tradition and values and family and commerce. In fact, some of the most amazing mathematical breakthroughs came from Persia that we are able to enjoy today. And now, unfortunately, the Persian people are forced to live under these maniacs in Iran that oppress their citizens completely and totally. And so I appreciate the question. Thank you guys so much for listening to this Ask Me Anything. We're going to do more of these in the future. Please leave your comments, press subscribe, give us 5 stars. We love doing this, and we so greatly appreciate it. We love the questions on any single topic across the world, across any sort of different vertical. This is what we enjoy doing at the Charlie Kirk Show, diving deep, giving you the facts, and please give us those 5-star ratings. Please leave us those reviews. We love it. We totally appreciate it. Until next time, this is Charlie Kirk signing off on the Charlie Kirk Show.
Hey, everybody, it's Laura Ingraham, and I'd like to invite you to check out my new show, The Laura Ingraham Podcast, exclusively on Podcast One. So join me 3 days a week as I cover politics, the culture, everything in between, laugh, learn, all at the same time. We got you locked and loaded, and you'll be ready for the week, ready for the month. And it's very easy. You just subscribe today, download new episodes exclusively at podcastone.com or wherever you find your favorite podcast. And you know mine's going to be one of your newest podcasts.